The Creative Life, a conversation series at UAlbany, is created and produced by the University Art Museum, New York State Writers Institute, and UAlbany Performing Arts Center, in collaboration with WAMC. The following conversation with Paul Reiser was recorded at UAlbany's Page Hall in April 2019. Comedian, actor, television writer, author, and musician Paul Reiser co-starred as Paul Buckman in the decade-defining 1990s comedy Mad About You. Other starring roles include Michael Taylor in 60 episodes of My Two Dads, Doug Getty in Red Oaks, and Dr. Sam Owens in Stranger Things. His films include Diner, Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2, Aliens, and Whiplash, and many more. Reiser is also the author of three bestsellers about family life, including Couplehood, Babyhood, and Familyhood. Please welcome to the stage Mr. Paul Reiser.
Thank you. This is very nice. You know, by the way, just to say, this is very sweet victory for me because I didn't get accepted here years ago.
You went to SUNY Binghamton.
Really? All of you? What are you
and,
doing here? Yeah, so I didn't get in, so here I am with no tuition whatsoever. So the joke's on them, that's what I say.
Excellent. Well, how'd you like Binghamton?
It was fine. I had a good time. You don't always need to see the sun all year. And it was fine. You see it once in a while, you appreciate it more.
You majored in what?
I majored in what? Yes. That was my question. I was a music major, not because I was planning to be a musician, but I studied piano since I was a kid, so I was halfway done with my credits. I went, well, I'll go that way. And then I had like a business minor in case I was going to be a normal person.
Yeah.
And then I straddled those worlds.
So at what point did you become a normal person? At no point, right? I mean, as far as business, that never came into the equation.
The thought was my dad had a successful food wholesale business, and it was always presumed that I was going to go into business and go into his footsteps. And so I straddled that for about 2 years, and I would work like a normal person, and then at night I would go into the comedy clubs and work for free at 2 a.m. And I just liked it, and I finally, about 2 years in, realized, yeah, that's really what I want to do. So that was a hard sell to my father. Like, explain it to me again. You're going to work late at night for no money with nothing, no possible rewards. Yes, that's the plan. That's the plan. That college degree was money well spent.
Now, who is your class of comedians? When you were doing the clubs early, who was in that class?
Larry Miller and Jerry Seinfeld. Seinfeld was actually the MC, and he'd only been doing it like a year, so he was like a sophomore, and I was a freshman. And at the time, the way that club was set up, the MC would be the guy who decides who gets to come into the pool. So you go on audition night, and three comedians actually passed the same night: Carol Leifer, who I went to college with, and Rich Hall, who went on to do some great things, and myself. And Jerry gave us the thumbs up, and here we are.
Excellent. Carol Leifer did a lot of work with Seinfeld.
Yeah, she was on Seinfeld.
And was on that show. And then Rich Hall was of Sniglet's fame.
You know everything, don't you? You know everything.
This stuff I know.
Joe's very, very up to date.
So that was a good life, right? I mean, being like in the clubs and coming up at that time, comedy was starting to boom.
Yeah, it was all nothing but fun, you know, staying up late and meeting girls and having nothing to do from like noon to 9 at night. And then you work 20 minutes and then you get to tell people you're a comedian. That was the fun part. People, you know. And the fun and the challenging part, like if you were on a plane and somebody said, what do? You go, I'm a comedian, which felt cool. And then they would say, you ever been on the Tonight Show? And you go, no. I go, well, then you're not a comedian until you are. 1982
was
the first time, yes.
It was on the Tonight
Show. So it
show.
Wasn't really that long. 79, I graduated in 77, and then 79, I really kind of committed myself to doing that. And then it was a couple of years later, I did the Tonight Show, 3 years.
So let's, I want to get to that in a second, but let's.
I got nowhere to be.
Okay, good. We have, so let's go back.
Go ahead.
I heard a story that I heard you tell, and you prefaced it as it being a true story. So I hope that's true. So I'll just set it up this way. Yeah. This is the way I heard the beginning of this story.
Okay.
Okay? You're 14 years old.
Oh, do you have film of whatever you're about to say? Because
no, you're 14 like years old.
Going, yeah.
You walk into your house, and sitting at your dining room table is George Carlin.
Yes, I was 16.
Oh, 16.
No, I was 16 because I had come from my driver's ed class, so I had to be 16. Yeah, Joe, I was a huge, this is 72, so I'm 16, yeah. So I was a huge George Carlin fan, and my sister, who was 3 years older than me, was in college, and she had a, I think she had a radio show. She went to AU, American in Washington, and somehow she got through to George Carlin's people and was going to interview him for her school thing, radio show. So we went to see him at the Palace Theater. It was right before the election in 72. And the next morning, she was supposed to see, go interview him, and he said, "You know, my wife is sick. I can't really do it here. Why don't I come to your house?" And so I was out. I didn't know any of this. And then I remember coming in. My father said, "Guess who's in the house?" I went, "Aunt Shirley." "I don't know who." He said, "George Carlin." I went, "Get what are you?" And then I walk in, and there's George Carlin, and he apparently did like a 3-hour interview with my sister, which I have somewhere. I have to find it. It was like a really long, extensive interview. And then he sat and he couldn't get out because my parents wouldn't let him go. Can I tell the whole story?
Yeah, I'm hoping you do. Oh, okay. I want the punchline.
Well, go ahead. Well, it's a little, okay, we got nowhere to be. And I had to clear, and I never saw him again in a professional life, but I did call him because I wanted to tell this story on Letterman, and I needed his blessing. So what happened was he was ready to go. And my parents said, "No, you got to stay for breakfast because you're not allowed to leave a Jewish home unless you've eaten too much." So he sat and he had lox and bagels with us. He says, "I really have to go." "No, where are you going?" And my father said, "Where are you going?" And George Carlin said, I got to go uptown." My father said, "Why?" And George said, "I have to buy a camera." My father said, "Don't go uptown. I want to take you to my guy downtown." And he says, "No, yeah, please." So he gets in the car. Now we're in the car. And I'm in the back. And I'm like the coolest kid in the world. People are driving by going, "That's George Carlin." And my father brings him downtown Manhattan to this discount place. And he says, "This is George Carlin. Take care of him. He wants to buy a camera." And that's the last I see of him. A year later, my sister does a follow-up interview with him. She said, "I don't know if you remember." He goes, "Oh, I remember." He says, "That was the strangest interview of my life." He said, "You know, I was on my way uptown to score some coke."
Yeah.
And my father made him buy a camera because he lied to my father. So let that be a lesson.
That's my favorite story.
And he got snookered into buying a camera.
Oh, that's priceless. So showing that all things come around here, your show that you did a couple years ago, which I just have to say, you mentioned this to me the other day. We did a pre-interview for this interview. And you mentioned this show, which I don't know how I missed it because this is like all I live for. It was the Carson show. You did a great show called There's Johnny.
Yeah, you're not the only person who missed it. Most of America missed it, but go ahead.
So you were not in it, but you wrote it, you directed it, you produced it.
I didn't direct it. I wrote it with a buddy of mine and produced it, yeah.
Wrote it and produced it. The show takes place in 1972. The Tonight Show had just moved from New York,
yeah,
to 30 Rock to
Burbank. Beautiful downtown Burbank.
Beautiful downtown Burbank. And it's getting ready for the 10th anniversary. And there's a young kid who writes a fan letter. And then...
And it's basically, it's sort of, if you picture the Larry Sanders Show, if that's behind the scenes of a fictional TV show, we had a fictional show, a fictional cast, fictional story, but set in a real world. And my friend David Simon, who, not the David Simon who wrote The Wire, different David Simon, he had this idea years ago, and I always thought it was appealing. Just let's be backstage at the Tonight Show. That's all we had. Because that was, to us, to a certain age, that was the coolest place to be. Especially when it moved to California, it became this constant cocktail party. It just looked like that was the place to be, and people would drop by, and there's Don Rickles, and there's, you know. Right. And I would stay up late to watch the comics when George Carlin was on, or Rodney Dangerfield, or Robert Klein, well, and David Brenner.
And that first episode, it's George Carlin.
Yes. So the story, so we just wanted to do it, and we came up with this story that a kid, a little guy from a farm in Nebraska, sweet, innocent kid, writes a letter to The Tonight Show asking for an autographed picture for his father, because his father loves Johnny Carson. That's the only thing that makes him happy. And they send him back a picture and a form letter. Hey, welcome to the NBC family. If you're ever in town, make sure you come by and say hello. And he interprets that as he's got a job. So he gets on his little bus and he goes across country and he lands, and they're all looking at him like, oh, you poor dumb guy. No, no. But he's so sweet, and because he's from Nebraska, Johnny takes a shine to him and they keep him. So we pitched the idea. We needed the cooperation of the Carson estate, Carson Company, which is now run by Johnny's nephew, who's like 65 or something. But when we told him this story, he said, you know, that's my life story. I said, no, I didn't know that. I just met you. And he said, yeah, when he was just out of college or just out of the service, his uncle John said to him, what are you doing now? He goes, I don't know. He said, well, why don't you come work here? He said, do what? He said, well, I don't know. We'll find something for you to do. So he was like this guy, and whatever he did, whatever he screwed up, nobody could touch him. He goes, that's Johnny's kid. Don't mess with Johnny's kid. So we had, that was our story, and we got to use clips, and we had, which was like being a kid in the candy store. We got to all these clips at our disposal, and so of course I just jumped in and said, well, let's start looking for comics, because you can use anything, right? So we said, and we started with George Carlin, and as happened, we found this piece of gold. It was exactly that time, and I realized when I did it, it was probably a week or so after he was in my house not buying coke. He did The Tonight Show, and he was on with a guy who was a very, I wouldn't say right-wing, but very conservative, arts conservative, almost like an evangelical psychiatrist who had written a book about abstention and about the absolute cultural opposite of George Carlin. And they got into it. And if you look, you see Johnny kind of just digging it. Like
just enjoying
it. He enjoyed putting people on watching sparks fly. Well, it turned out that was exactly the story we wanted to tell. It was like, here's this little kid from a farm who's thrown into this world of Hollywood, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and went, oh, look at this piece of gold. We found this. So that was really a fortuitous discovery. And then we did 7 episodes, and it was, I was really, really thrilled with it. It came out better than I had hoped. But it was one of those things where we did it for a streaming service called CISO, which was an NBC Comcast thing that folded right after we finished, at least we finished. And then it got shipped to Hulu, and Hulu said, like, what is this? We got to put this on? Okay, put that on. So they didn't raise it as their own. They just fed it and bare minimum requirements.
Well,
so that's why nobody's heard of it, ever.
It's on Hulu, and if you get it, you have to see it. It's so, so good. I loved it. So last night I binged it, and I watched the whole thing. So second episode is when I fell in love. I knew that I had met... I had met the show of my dreams. There's a young woman who is the
Jane Levy.
The actress. My God, is she good in it?
Yeah.
And she's booking Albert Brooks.
Yes.
Now there's a clip with Albert Brooks in it.
Yes.
But the minute I hear her on the phone with Albert Brooks,
right,
who is then I realize Kevin Pollak.
Yes.
Who used to call up all the time as Albert Brooks on the old Larry King show
how do you
overnight.
Know that? Really? You know
everything. The mutual broadcasting system, and Kevin would call in, and Larry wouldn't know. So, he had a show from midnight to 5 a.m. on a radio show. He did it all night long.
5 hours.
Yeah. That was before CNN said, oh, wow, you're really telegenic. Go on television. And
he said, wait, I got to buy suspenders.
That's right. I got to buy
now
suspenders.
Now we can shoot.
And
we wanted Albert Brooks, and I called Albert Brooks, and he kind of like very nervous about, he said, I'm doing a thing, a voiceover, and I don't think legally, he got very nervous.
He couldn't be his own voice?
Well, if he was doing some show, whatever, or he didn't want to. And he goes, get Kevin Pollak, he does a good me. I said, okay, so Kevin was an old friend. But then, this was the other trip. and I know Albert Brooks very casually, but he was one of those guys. I don't know if you remember, Albert Brooks is kind of a genius. I mean, he's really, and he's one of the few, the only guy I know. He never was a comedian out in the world. He told me this on the phone, which I didn't. He tried his things out for the first time on The Tonight Show. And if it worked, he would go out and do it. I went, the other way around. Don't do that. But he was so bold. And Johnny was a king for a reason. I mean, and he loved comedians. And there was no competition. Part of why comics loved him. He loved them, and he wanted them to do well. And if you ever watch old reruns, and they're available, you can get, one of the things we found out doing that is that the Johnny Carson DVD collection is the number one selling DVD collection on Amazon for the last 7 years. So we thought, all right, so there's an audience for this if Hulu would put it out. So where was I going? Every time, the first time I did Tonight Show, and anytime anybody ever did it, Johnny would always introduce him virtually the same way. He would say, I'm glad you're in a good mood tonight. We have a bright young comedian. And the audience would go, we're not in a good mood. Okay, I guess we are. You know, and he would make them sit up and go, he's my guest, she's my guest, make them welcome. And that really fed your success. So I did it one time in 82 when Diner came out, and then I didn't do it for a while. And then somewhere like 86 or so, he took a shine to me, and I did it a lot. I can't believe how much, looking back, it seems like every couple of months, which is a lot, from like 87, 86 to 90 or something, he had me on a lot. And he was so warm and so supportive. It was really, looking back, it's pretty touching.
Now, was that, I've heard differing things from comedians as to, you hear the quintessential story that you are scraping for bus money, you go on that show and your life changes. And then I've heard the complete opposite.
There's a rule. I think that happened for some people. You know, it happened for David Brenner.
Yep.
And it happened for Freddie Prinze, went from nothing to exploding. But for a lot of people, but for me, it didn't do that. But what it did do, as I was saying before, you're not really official until you've done The Tonight Show. That's the ultimate stamp of approval. Like for my parents or for most people. Like, did you ever do The Tonight Show? Yeah, well, then I guess you are a comedian. That was it. And there's no comparable thing now. You know, you can be on Colbert or, I don't, you know, anybody, but it's not the same stamp of approval that Johnny Carson was.
You did, the only thing that came close was Letterman, but that was afterwards, yeah.
I don't think Dave was ever really rooting for people's success as Johnny was. You know, I mean, not that he was against, but he was, you know, his whole stance was very, he was like your very hip cousin who would like bust your balls.
Right.
Whereas Johnny was your really sweet uncle.
Was really helping.
Yeah, help you, yeah.
I've heard, again, many comedians will say that one of the highlights of their career is saying something and hearing Johnny laugh.
Nothing better.
Yeah.
I remember I remember very clearly, I did a, just an ad lib. I was cleaning out my closet and I found this mountain of cassettes that I hadn't seen. And I can see that over with each successive appearance, I got a little more relaxed and I became more comfortable and I would play with Johnny more. And one time he said something and I just threw out an ad lib that took him and he just literally fell over backwards laughing. And I remember thinking I was in this heightened reality. Like I don't know how to extend this moment. Do I breathe? What? And I remember the next day I went to the improv and Rodney Dangerfield was there and he goes, hey, I really made Johnny laugh last night. I went, apparently that was, he registered it. Like people go, if you made Johnny laugh, it was the greatest thing. Yeah, it was the ultimate approval.
That is amazing. And one more thing about There's Johnny that I just
Please,
would like
take
to
your
say.
Time. Nobody has seen it ever. You're not ruining anything.
You have to see it. It's on really Hulu. There's Johnny. So this is going to sound like I'm being negative, and I don't mean to be negative, but I don't know. Tony Danza was the Who's the Boss guy. I didn't know. He did a talk show for a while. He sings, he dances, he fights in a ring. I don't know a lot about him. My God, he nails Freddie DeCordova in this thing.
Tony,
he is just like an amazing character actor.
He's great. He's really great. I really got to love him. He's a great guy. It's a fictitious show. So we created this kid, and we created this young woman, Jane Levy, who works at the show, and he's sort of under her umbrella, and he's never met a woman who's this open and this sexual and this screwed up. I mean, he's never met a neurotic person. Being in Nebraska, everything is just face value. And so everybody's fictitious, and we created the writing staff, and everybody was made up. The only real person was Freddie DeCordova, who was Johnny's longtime producer. And he was a guy with big square glasses and always sitting in the back by smoking and sitting by the monitors. And we really couldn't make him up. And we also didn't, we didn't show Johnny. We didn't have any actor play Johnny because it would just be false. You know, everybody knew Johnny Carson so well on TV. So all we did is you'd see somebody walk by and you see a shock of gray hair or a shoulder or a piece of, there's Johnny, which was all I ever saw. When I wasn't sitting with him, you didn't pal around with him. You just, in fact, it was sort of like when the president moves, like everything was locked down. Oh, Johnny's going back to his dressing room. So everybody stands and whoosh, you see a plaid suit go by. You go, well, there he is. You know, he's going into his car, waiting. No, no. So that was my recollection. He was just this huge presence, but you didn't interact. He just, you know, he was just in the ether. But Freddie was such a real person and a real character. He was a Hollywood director. He did Bedtime for Bonzo with Ronald Reagan,
yeah,
which Johnny used to tease him about all the time. But and Tony Danza had done the show. He actually, I think, hosted the show once. But he knew Freddie very well. And he jumped into this role. And so many people have said it was like three episodes before they realized it was Tony Danza. And he didn't do anything that different. He's gray-haired by himself and just put on some glasses. And he's great. I don't know what Freddie's job was. Producer is a very vague term in Hollywood. You can be the money person or you can be the nuts and bolts guy. He was neither of those. He was basically like the greeter. He was like Joe Louis in Vegas. He would just come into your dressing room and he would like, and we put a line in, and he just always reeked this old world of like a lot of cologne and vodka and Marlboros. Just like a walking cocktail party.
Melange.
What's that?
Yeah.
And a party just walked by. And he would come into the room and he would just kibitz from the door. Hey, okay. And you go, I don't know what just happened. He just came in and he said something. And that
now,
was his job.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that basically the Rip Torn character on Larry Sanders? I mean, that was kind of the same type of thing of, you didn't really know.
Yes.
He was sort of the intermediary between Larry and the world, and Fred was that for Johnny.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
I don't think Fred was as buffoonish as
fictitious. Once you're in that, 82, you're on The Tonight Show, and you start, as you say, 86, and then you start doing the movies, right? You start, Diner is...
Well, Diner was 82. They kind of dovetail. The reason I got on The Tonight Show when I did was because of Diner. I don't think, I wasn't really that formed as a comic, and I don't think I was ready, because it wasn't even a hierarchy. They had a guy that would come out, and he would see you, and he would say, you're ready or you're not ready, and I wasn't ready. But then when Diner came out in April of 82... suddenly they went, all right, that's a good reason to put this kid on. And so that was, I sort of got my foot in the door that way.
How old were you at this point?
82, I'm 26.
Yeah. Because you look like you're 10 in that movie.
In the movie? Yeah.
Yeah,
well, I was 24, I guess, when that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was my first job. I had never seen a camera. And, you know, half of the stuff that I did in the movies, you know, where I was so indecisive, it's because I had no idea where I was supposed to be. There was a scene where we're coming out of the diner and everybody's getting into their car and I didn't have a car. And I said to Barry Levinson, the director, I said, well, who should I go with him? He goes, let's see what happens. Let me see what happens. So I stood on the steps and
with you? Well, it's just sort of you and Steve Guttenberg sort of going at it.
And he goes,
yeah.
Well, just ask. I don't want to ask, but if you're going, I'll go with you. You know, it's like, and suddenly that was in the movie. I had no idea what I was doing, but Barry Levinson was very smart. And that was the whole thing with the, it's very much ahead of its time, that movie. I mean, I was thrilled to be in a movie that had, you know, film and cameras and stuff, but I was happy to be in any movie. But they, at the time, like Porky's and those kind of movies were the really big hits, these teen sex cheesy romps. And Diner, the studio, thought they were getting that. And then Barry Levinson gives them this thing, which is very subtle. And there was my favorite, it's really the quintessential note of this movie. There was a scene where it was improvised, again, because I had no lines. Everything I did, he just encouraged me to improvise. So the scene where I'm arguing about the sandwich, you want it, you ask for it. I don't want to ask for it, but if you can have... And the studio looked at that, and that was sort of the scene that everybody remembers, or certainly that I remember. And the studio looked at the screening, and they went, well, why doesn't he just give him the damn sandwich and get on with the movie? And Barry goes, there is no movie. That's the movie. This, it's guys being with each other. That's all it is. And
a show about nothing. A movie about nothing.
Yeah, but it was way before nothing existed.
Yeah.
He invented nothing.
You made something.
We made something from nothing.
From nothing. Then Beverly Hills Cop 1, and then Aliens, and Beverly Hills Cop 2, and then it just kept going.
Nobody told me to stop.
That's good.
I kept waiting for them to catch on.
Yeah. And then when did My Two Dads come into it?
Okay, here's a funny story. Well, it's not funny, but it's kind of pathetic. That
oh, we like those.
And I told this to my manager, who I've been with for like 10 years now, and he just thinks this is the perfect Hollywood story, but it's like, and it's kind of sad. When I did My Two Dads, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to do it. It was like I had been out there in L.A. a couple of years, and I was down to my last couple of bucks. I went, I should probably do something. And then this pilot came up, and I went, I guess I'll do a pilot. It's not going to go. I didn't like it. I didn't think it was particularly great. I said, this is not going to go. I'll just do it. And I got a nice check, and I said, I'm good for a while, good for a couple of months. And about a month later, my manager at that time called me and said, hey, you're going to New York next week for the big network presentation because the pilot got picked up. And I actually said, what pilot? The thing with the kid and, oh, no, really? Oh, I didn't mean to do that. And so I fought it. I really didn't want to be in there. And they were nice people, and they were lovely people. And it took me a while to just accept that, you know what, I'm making a product that I myself don't use in the home. You know, it's like, okay, you don't have to enjoy this. But what it did, it was as a result of that, and it went 3 years, which was more than enough. I was really quite happy when we were done. But it did give me, more of a presence. And I was approached by a studio. They said, we'd love you to develop something for yourself. And I met at the time, this would have been 90, 89 or 90, something like 90. And I said, well, I don't know that I really want to do another half hour. I didn't love that so much. And they said, well, write whatever you'd like. And at the time, my stand-up was all about being newlywed. It was about, my material was about living together and then being married. And I said, well, if I was going to do a show, I'd want it to be like that. I mean, that small, just like a relationship. And they go, well, write that. And that became Mad About You. And they said, And again, it was fortuitous timing because they were looking for something to put with Seinfeld. Seinfeld hadn't really broken out the show. It was sort of an underground hit.
It was all over the place.
For about a year or so. Like, a lot of the hip people knew it, but hadn't become a hit. And they said, well, here's these two, and they kind of go together. So that was another sort of linked little association. But you know, you look back, there's never a plan, and I always tell people, like, I never had any plan. I mean, even Diner, I got by accident. I literally walked into the wrong room, and they were casting this movie, and they told me to come back. I went, I don't know, I'm in the wrong. And then My Two Dads, I didn't mean to do it.
Love to know that you sort of did that show under duress. I think that's great.
I remember, and I was like kind of like fighting with one hand behind my back, and then I remember, like the sixth or seventh week, I kind of just stopped fighting it, and I leaned into a joke, and the producer came over and says, where you been? I went, yeah, I didn't want to give you the good stuff. I didn't. I was saving it.
I remember...
That's so unflattering to share.
But it's... But the show was
keep
popular.
That to yourselves.
But see, that's the thing. The show was popular.
The show was popular. Again...
I mean, people like
you know
that.
What the, yes, you know, but people come...
watch that. They didn't watch There's Johnny. They watched that.
Yeah, well, are you trying to kill me?
Yeah, I know. Just no, pointing
but see,
out
the
absurdities of life.
The absurdities of life. The comment that I got while that show was on, My Two Dads, was, my daughter loves that show. I'm going, okay.
Yeah.
I don't want your daughter to not be happy, God bless, but
right. It's
not the show I would watch. It's not the show. So that was really the focus. So for Mad About You, he's like, I want to do a show that I would watch and that my peers would watch. And so to that extent, it was very successful. That it's like, oh, when I went out, people went, oh, man, that's my marriage. That's exactly the argument that we had in our house yesterday. And I think, oh, good. We did it right.
So then they announced that you're gonna reboot it.
Yes. Well, reboot is the is an odd word.
Well, what the hell are you gonna do then?
When did Joe turn on me? When did this happen? You know, for years, we knew when we did our seventh season, we said, this is going to be the end, and we wanted to end it, and we did. Really, we were very gratified. We did everything we wanted to do, every show, every idea that we had written on a scrap of paper. Like, we did that. We did the threat of adultery. We did the infertility. We did that. We did everything. And when we did our finale, we did a one-hour special where we jumped into the future, and we showed what happened to them 10 years, 20 years, and they broke up, they got back together. And we did that for a number of reasons, but one of which was we want to make sure we never attempted to come back. Let's not be one of those dummies that says, here they are, look how old Dick Van Dyke is now. You don't want to do that. And so we were really, and Helen and I would have lunch all the time over the years, and it was never a thought. And then, 2 years ago, when people started coming back, jokingly said, well, would you want to do it? It's like, no, really? Maybe?
It's like Will and Grace, Roseanne.
Well, everybody, and they were doing
Murphy
well.
Brown, yeah.
And so I didn't want to, neither of us wanted to do it just for the sake of doing it. I mean, the appeal was to play together because we had such a good time and we did 160 things. And it was a lot of work. I mean, those years you spend more time with your, TV family, the crew and everybody, than you do your own family. So we were all very close and it was great. And we really had a great relationship and a great chemistry. That was the word people always said. What chemistry? So so we didn't want to do it, but then we thought about it, and we said, well, what would we, if we did, what would be the reason? What story are you telling? And then we realized, in the time, and we went off the air in 99, and then the next year I had my second son. And so I was really taking some time off and really happy to be home. But in this last year, my son went off to college, and I always heard this word, empty nest, but I didn't get what it means. It's like, oh, it's quiet in here. And the premise of the pilot, of the original Mad About You was, you're a few months into marriage and the reality kicks in, right?
Right.
And the way we sold the show was, we said, you know when you go to a party with your wife, your husband, and like you're being social and you're having a good time, then you leave, you say goodnight, you get into the car. The minute that car door closes, that's the show. Right? When one of you goes, why did you say that? I didn't say, you said, but you didn't have to bring that. So it was that intimacy. And we realized that this is exactly, it's a very similar moment. When your kids are out of the house and it's just you two again, you're faced with that reality. But now it's 25, 30 years down the road, so you're not really the same people, and you'd kind of go, we have to get back what we had. It's like, yeah, but can you? Because we were 25, and now I'm 60, so I don't think we can get it back. But we thought that was a really interesting thing, because the show was always about the relationship and the hard work and the elbow grease that it takes, the commitment that it takes to make it work. Because it's really easy at any point to go, you know what? Let's just walk away. This is hard. It's like, yes, of course it's hard. But if you want to make it work,
so that's
what do you
where
do?
That's where it is when we. When
so
we
saw.
We
haven't figured out any of the stories, but basically that moment where our child, our daughter, is leaving, and when we went and we pitched it around, and we said, here's what it is: like, the kid is out, and we're looking at each other, going, well, what do we have now? Is it because there is this moment? I remember. Turning to my wife and saying, well, what were you saying in 1992? What were we saying? Because we're talking, all the energy's on your kids, and that's like, oh, it's us again. And it's not as romantic, it's not as passionate, it's not as energetic, it's very different. You're different people. So we said, it's the decision that you have to make, because on one hand you say, you know what, you put in 25 years, nothing to be ashamed of. We can walk away proud. Head held high. Nobody loses here. Good for us, 25 years. Let's walk away. Don't wait till it turns to go now.
It's not an Italian
right.
restaurant,
and then
for God's
right.
sake.
But on the other hand, you go, we're so close to death. Stick it out. Right? So that's really what we're operating from. Like, look, and I know this is going to be hard, and we're not the same people we were. Do you want to make the effort? And invariably, we always land on, yes, we will.
Yeah.
But how you do it is the fun of the show.
So it's not like Mad At You, is it?
No. No, that's another show. No, but it's, we have very light jokey conversations with my wife where we'll both say, you know, we don't need this anymore. We don't know. I'd be so happy traveling without you. I'd be thrilled. Go. Yes.
Now, I will tell.
So not that you should go, but I don't want to go. You go, and I'll be here.
And the first thing you did when you came in, you said, let me take a picture of the crowd so I can send it to my wife.
Yes, I did, but I didn't take it because it was dark.
You can take
yes,
it.
Yes, I was going to say it because I wanted to know that I actually am in Albany doing what I said I was doing. Proof of life.
Yes. So now this, probably only I care about this. I find it fascinating. I think this is interesting.
It's your show. Why shouldn't it be
well,
what you
care
about?
Well, you know, that gave that up a long time ago. So you will, so to see you right now, you're streaming on Netflix in Stranger Things.
Yes.
You're streaming on Hulu for There's Johnny. You're streaming on Amazon Prime for Red Oaks.
Okay.
And you will be streaming on the new Spectrum system, which will be Mad About You.
Yes, and I'm doing the second season of Kominsky Method on Netflix.
On
Netflix. See, that they heard of.
That's good. Alan
Arkin,
when
you're done
Michael,
with that, go watch Johnny, you know,
yeah.
There's Johnny. Yeah, that's fun. Wow. I mean, talk about a dream.
That's a lot of talent in a show.
You know, the Kominsky Method was created by Chuck Lorre. Chuck
yes.
Lorre is the king of television. He's like the Norman Lear. Nobody's done what he's done since Norman Lear. He created Big Bang Theory, which is the longest running show ever.
Two and a Half Men
and Mom and Mike and Molly and
Sybil.
He ran all these shows. Yeah. He's just hugely talented. And I know him because he was the baby junior writer on My Two Dads from 30 years ago. That was his first job.
Wow.
He said on the pilot, he had never written. He was a musician. And he, like I'd like, I got to do something to pay the rent. Maybe I'll write on this crazy thing. And I knew him over the years, and I've been really excited and proud of his success. So I wrote him. When I saw this, I thought, wow, this is... It's so different. It's a single camera, and it's
right.
not an audience show. It looks like a movie. For a guy who does that format so well, I thought he did a brilliant job. And you know, Michael Douglas, who's like the biggest movie star in the world, and Alan Arkin, who's like one of my idols, and these guys are great. And I was watching, I go, that's what I want to do. I'd love that. I said, by the way, two Jews sitting in a car, I can do that. You know, there's not a lot of action sequence. They're sitting constantly. I went, that's me, baby. So I walked around enough. If you watch Mad About You, there's a lot of walking around. I'd like to sit down for a while. So here's another kind of crazy thing. So I called him, and I sent him an email. And I said, hey, the show is great and good for you. You did a great job. And I kind of half joking, I said, we should do that. I said, let's you and me come up with a show like that. Because periodically he would say, you know, we should do something. He said, well, why don't we have lunch? And I said, okay. And I threw some three or four bad ideas at him. And he went, would you like to be on this show? And I said, okay. He said, you don't have to answer now. I go, I am. Yes, 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 I am. And apparently he already had this role in mind. And it was supposed to be a little older. So it was to be Michael Douglas. It's sort of more like Michael Douglas's age. And Michael's, I don't know, maybe 10 years older than me. So we had this meeting, and I said, yeah, great. I don't even have to count me in. Whatever you say, I'm in. And he said, we want to make a little change. We want to give you a bald cap. We want to make you bald. I said, okay. He said, we want to give you a gut. I said, I got a gut. I said, and the hair is going. I said, just wait 18 months. I'll save you some money. We could just shoot a little later. I'm there. And so we went in. So now we do this thing where it's three. I've never done this before. It's like 3 hours of makeup, and these guys are great, and they really... I became my father. I looked like, oh my God, and I get to play with these guys. And I don't know if you had asked me. Someone said, does it ever get old? I went, no. I'm like, and every minute I'm going, here's Alan Arkin, and I'm talking to Alan Arkin.
Yeah,
it's pretty. It's great. It's really fun, and it's very unlike. The whole vibe of it is very different than doing a half hour. There's no audience, so you can do as many takes. You can play, and even though the script is written and it's tight, they encourage you to play and. You know, and I'm still, it's like going to acting school because I'm watching Michael Douglas and you go, I don't think he's doing anything. It doesn't look like he's trying hard. And then you look at it on film and go, wow, that's why he's a movie star. That's great. It didn't
good
look
job.
Like anything. But, you know, anybody who's looking like it's too much is probably not doing a good job. But he's just so smooth and good and funny and really funny.
And I would assume, I would think that you would just want to just ask those two, especially... Alan Arkin, just tell me everything you know about Hollywood and show business.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Alan Arkin, The In-Laws was my favorite movie.
Yeah.
One of my favorite movies, The In-Laws, Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. And I got to work with Peter Falk. I made a movie with him about 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And so we were sharing Peter Falk stories. And I went back and I watched a lot of Alan Arkin movies. He was great. I mean, I those are the two guys, Peter Falk and Alan Arkin, that the only actors that I responded to when I was a kid. Because I didn't like, you know, you watch Mickey Mantle and you want to be a baseball player. But I never wanted to be an actor. Like, it didn't appeal to me. But those two guys were on some other level that I don't know what, but I went, that. I don't know if I want to be that, but I want to watch more of that. And so that I got to work with each of them is kind of pinch me crazy.
And they both are somewhat caricatures and yet completely genuine.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I think the other guy who I loved in that category was Jack Lemmon.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the thing that ties them all is they don't fall into a category. They're really funny and they're really rich, deep, dramatic actors, and they don't have to shift too much to change. You know, you watch The In-Laws, part of what's so spectacular about the Peter Falk. Do you know the movie? Have you seen The In-Laws? Peter Falk, it's a great movie. And the whole thing is you don't know the whole movie if he's crazy or not. Like, he's with the CIA and he stopped the Cuban Missile Crisis? What? The Bay of Pigs? That was, and he'll just lean a little this way and you go, oh, I get it, he's crazy. And then he'll just shift a little bit and you go, oh, he's dead serious. Okay, I got it. And like, wow, there's not a lot of guys who can do that. And Jack Lemmon, break your heart and really, really funny. And Alan Arkin, same thing. So there's something. So Tom Hanks is in that world too. I mean, he's done so much. But Tom Hanks is just a naturally funny guy. But he straddles all worlds. He can take you wherever he wants to take you.
The role that sort of got me, this is who Paul Reiser has become. This is what seemed to be Whiplash.
Oh, really?
Do you know? I mean, meaning no, as far I, as an actor. I mean, it was a lovely role.
Well, yeah. You know, somebody said, you know, how do you feel about playing a dad? And I go, great. I love, you know, I am a dad. I love being a dad. And that was a really tiny role. But in Whiplash, Damien Chazelle wrote this. He was 26 when he wrote this. He's so talented, and but he wrote this really beautiful relationship where the father, this kid, if you haven't seen Whiplash, he's a drummer under the sway of this really kind of psychopathic, musical demanding music teacher, and the father is a sort of underachieving, teaches high school English, never reached his dream. And the kid feels that and goes, I don't want to be my dad. I don't want to, you know, which every kid feels. I don't want to settle like my dad did. And the father is trying to help and protect. And that's really, he landed on something that was in the script that was so true and so painful, is that there, at a certain point, there is nothing you can do, right? And part of being a parent is, okay, please don't hit a wall. Please don't, you know. Right. But you can only do so much. And that really appealed to me in the script. It was like, oh, I'm trying to protect him, but I can't. And okay.
So you didn't completely agree with me on that. That is sort of
surprised.
What would you think that would be?
I don't know. I thought this was forming me. I thought this was. I thought people go, you know, I met a guy
clearly,
from the University of Albany thing. That was who he is. No, that's who he is. No, I would sometimes get offered roles for things I didn't like, for really broad movies or not great sitcom. And I would have to sort of explain to my agents, and like, well, why don't you like that? I said, well, you're playing a dad. He goes, well, you like playing a dad. I go, yeah, but a dad is not like the only defining thing. Like, they can't be the butt of the jokes. Like, it's like, you know, in bad writing, the dad is, oh, the guy who's walking around scratching himself and, you know, and belching. It's like the joke can't be, oh, he's an old guy dad. That's not really funny, and it's kind of cliche. But if you're exploring what it means to be a parent, that's, you know, infinite. And I get what you're saying, because it's certain, I could not have done that movie at 30. You have to sort of know. But that was really informative for me, too. The movie that I did with Peter Falk, where he plays my father, I wrote that in 2003, but I had the idea in 82. And I would just put it away. And all I knew is that I wanted Peter Falk to play my father, just because I thought because I wanted to be in a movie with Peter Falk. And he reminded me of my father. But I didn't know what the movie was until I had actually my second kid. And I went, I get it. Now I know what the movie is. What is the push-pull between a father and son? And that movie is really that. It's like, boy, I love my father, but boy, I don't want my relationship with my wife to be what I perceive as my parents' relationship in the movie. And then you find out, yeah, you don't know anything. You know, you think you understand your parents. You don't know what's under the surface, and it's kind of presumptuous to think you do. So that world has always been interesting to me of knowing your parents and now being on the flip side where I'm that guy. You know, when I was on Red Oaks and I realized, I go, they're all looking at me like how an arc, and I go, tell us about Hollywood. I go, what? Like, I'm Pop's comedy now. When did I become that guy? Like, I suddenly transitioned. I'm the old guy? Okay.
Well, you were the, fair enough. The dad and that. And yeah. That. Yeah.
Tell us about James Cameron. I go, no. Look it up yourself.
You know what you need. Now, two dads.
Hey, that's a show.
that's a show.
And Angela Lansbury could play our daughter.
Our April 2019 Creative Life interview with Paul Reiser. The Creative Life, a conversation series at UAlbany, is created and produced by the University Art Museum, New York State Writers Institute, and UAlbany Performing Arts Center in collaboration with WAMC.